on case number 85935, the Nevada Policy Research Institute, Inc. versus Brittany Miller et al. Are the parties ready to proceed? Everyone ready? Okay. All right. So would you like to reserve some time today?
Yes, please. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. And as you know, and as you heard also today, you'll get the yellow light in the tone, but the clock keeps running.
Correct. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Kadish, Associate Justices, Counsel. My name is Colleen McCarty, and I represent the appellant, Nevada Policy Research Institute. This court's prior precedent provides a clear roadmap for the relief that NPRI seeks, a merits decision holding that dual service, exercising the powers of the legislature while simultaneously exercising any executive branch functions, violates the separation of powers clause of the Nevada Constitution. This is the only result that reaches the fullness of conception of separation of powers involving all of the elements of its meaning, and it is the only way to attain the maximum protection for the people, which this court has aspired to do since Galloway versus Truesdale. While NPRI appreciates the magnitude of the decision before you, this is some 100 years in the making, this court must resist at all costs the temptation to find a middle ground. Doing so would only perpetuate the longstanding uncertainty surrounding dual service. The plain language of Article 3, Section 1 provides, the powers of the government of the state of Nevada shall be divided into three separate departments, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. And no persons charged with the exercise of powers properly belonging to one of these departments shall exercise any functions appertaining to either of the others. The provisions refers to powers and functions, not powers and powers. This was not a drafting error by the framers. It was a strategic choice of words to denote a broader field of potentially encroaching activities. Respondents Dina Neal and James Orenshaw, as members of the Nevada State Senate, and Brittany Miller and Selena Torres, as members of the Nevada State Assembly, are charged with the exercise of legislative power. This is not in dispute. But where the parties disagree and what this court must decide is whether the separation of powers clause prohibits a person charged with the exercise of powers belonging to the legislative branch from exercising any functions, by virtue of their government employment appertaining to the executive branch. NPRI submits without question. The answer is yes.
So does that mean that, you know, that they can't be a janitor at UNLV either, not just a professor?
Absolutely, Justice Kadish.
All right.
The separation of powers is meant to ensure that there is not a concentration of power in one branch. And whether you are a janitor or whether you are the top of any executive department, when you have people serving in the legislature who are also serving in government employment with executive branch functions, there is the opportunity for a concentration of power with the executive exerting influence over the legislature.
Go ahead.
Ms. McCarty, then with due deference then to the drafters, do you distinguish between state and local?
That was going to be my question, actually.
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. I do not believe that the separation of powers is limited only to state government. Article 3, Section 1 provides for a government divided again into three branches. There are not four branches of government. And this court has held in the Commission on Ethics versus Hardy that each agency created by the legislature must have a primary connection to and derive its authority from one of the three branches of government. That same year, the United States Supreme Court in USURA versus Pocatello Education Association said, political subdivisions of states, counties, cities, or whatever never have been considered as sovereign entities. State political subdivisions are merely departments of the state, and the state may withhold or grant or withdraw powers and privileges as it sees fit.
But haven't we previously held that county and municipal entities are distinct from state governments in our like Nunes decision?
Additionally, there's other case law at this court, and candidly, it is a little bit all over the map. But you can also look to the city of Reno versus the county of Washoe, where this court said that the principle is well settled, that local government units are created as agencies for exercising the government powers of the state as the state may entrust to them. There also a bit of this, a City of Finley case, which you may have seen as well, which doesn't work for my side. But when you look at that case, there's no analysis. It's a footnote. Frankly, I'm not sure how the court came to that decision. But there is ample case law of this court that says that the power must be derived from somewhere. There is no fourth branch of government.
Can I ask you, before we even get any further, I'm a little concerned about the joinder issue and not joining all interested parties. Can you address that?
Yes, Justice Peregrine, thank you. In this particular case, we believe that the parties are adequately represented by the respondents. They have come forward. All of the interests are being represented by them. And therefore, we do not believe that you need to join everyone else.
Well, isn't if you've got parties that are affected under a declaratory relief, how are their interests, particular interests, represented? And why isn't that a due process?
We believe their particular interests are represented because the respondents here are dual-serving members of both the legislature and serving executive functions in government, be it local or state. NPRI endeavored to add the additional legislators that have entered the same category by virtue of elections, by virtue of resignations. Unfortunately, given the time it has taken for us to get here, that's been a moving target. Well, we believe that the respondents can adequately represent them.
But if we narrowly define the term function, and I agree with you, duty and function is not the same as powers and duties. They're different, and function could be construed more broadly, as other jurisdictions have done. But some jurisdictions have construed it more narrowly. If we just construed it more narrowly, then isn't it fair to say that legislatures who have not been added to this lawsuit would be deprived of due process, because there may be a different analysis and they may want to raise their own arguments, and this case may not have finality otherwise, which is the whole reason why we have the mandatory joinder under NRCP 19A, right?
Yes, but I agree, under that analysis, there would never be an ability for this case to come to this court. It will continue to move. And so,
That is the quagmire, yeah. I understand.
It is NPRI's position that the attorneys for NPRI, the attorneys for respondents, have addressed the pertinent arguments. They have looked at the case law, not only here in Nevada, but also in other states, to address this in the fullest possible way.
Do you think, because the legislature itself is a party to the case, that solves that problem, because the legislature is a representative body of all of its members? And perhaps that's a way to look at it.
I think this court has held previously that the legislature cannot represent its members. And so I'm not sure that solves the problem. I do think, however, that there is the joinder issue is not something that should preclude you from rendering a decision. And if it is, then this case can never, ever be decided, because it will continue to move.
And if a non-party legislator wants to distinguish whatever the outcome of this case is vis-a-vis his or her particular executive branch position or local government position or whatever it is, they are able to do that under normal preclusion rules, correct?
I would agree with that analysis, Justice Pickering. Of course, as I mentioned in my opening, it is certainly NPRI's position that trying to parse this out or find some sort of a middle ground creates a tremendous lack of uncertainty. The folks who work for public agencies need to know whether or not they can run for office. The folks who run for office need to know whether or not, if they win, they're going to be able to obtain their seats. And the folks who are in the legislature need to know whether they get to remain. And if you create a situation where it's being parsed out and it's different jobs and it's different functions, every time someone files for office, you're opening the door to a lawsuit as to whether or not that person is qualified under whatever decision is rendered here. Additionally, when we look at constitutional interpretation, the Sotomayor case made it clear that this court will not read language into a provision that isn't contained there. You will not find sovereign functions anywhere in the plain language. You will not find public officers
anywhere in the plain language. And when a constitutional provision's language is clear on its face, the court must construe it as the text as written. The reading suggested by the respondents essentially reduces the separation of powers to nothing more than a provision on dual office holding. That already exists in the Constitution under Article 4, Section 9, and was later codified under NRS 281.055. It would also perpetuate the long-standing status quo. Public employees would continue to serve in the legislature while also working in state and local governments. But NPRI submits to you that just because Nevada has always done it this way doesn't make it constitutional.
Has there been any indication that, we've been doing it this way since 1939, I think, that there has been an aggregation of executive power within the legislative branch or vice versa? Has there been any evidence of that?
The potential certainly exists for abuses, and indeed abuses have occurred. When you look at government employee legislators who have served as super lobbyists, essentially, for their local government employers, Wendell Williams is a perfect example. He acknowledged on the record that he was offered a promotion if he got a certain piece of legislation through. Teachers and other government employees have advocated for their own pay raises, and prosecutors and public defenders who create the laws, they want to either enforce or restrict the ones they think are too punitive. The separation of powers was meant to ensure that the legislature serves the needs of the people, not the needs of the government itself.
But the same could be said, frankly, for every other legislator. Whether if they're not a public employee, but they're a criminal defense attorney in private practice, they may have things they benefit from that happens in the legislature. Or for that matter, a plumber, an electrician, there, lots of things may affect them. So how is it different? Like, I don't know. I think that proves too much.
I agree, Justice Kadas, that the potential exists, but the issue with the separation of powers is the concentration of power. You've got people who are working in the executive branch, then exerting their influence in the legislature. It's not just one individual with their own personal interests. We're talking about stripping the separation of powers and stripping the legislature from representing the people to creating the potential, if not the reality, that they're representing government itself. That's not what the separation of powers clause was meant to do.
And if how would someone sweeping the floors or cleaning the bathrooms over at a UNLV building constitute a concentration of power?
I'm going to answer that question very quickly, and then I'm going to
appreciate that.
Justice Kennedy, I would submit to you that in the Galloway case, the issue was whether or not it was a separation of powers problem for a judge to affirm the licenses of a marriage officiant. That doesn't seem like a really big deal either. But this court found that it was. And this court found that it was a separation of powers violation. It was the same in Desert Chrysler. In that case, it was judges being asked to approve a new car dealership. Again, doesn't seem like the grandest violation, but this court found that it was. We're not asking you to take a huge leap here. Your precedent brings us to where we are today. And we are asking for just a small step further. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Mr. Powers, are you making the argument for all of the respondents today, or are you dividing up the time at all?
I am making all the arguments for all of the respondents today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. For the record, Kevin Powers, General Counsel, LCB Legal Division, on behalf of the respondent legislature of the state of Nevada. Also here today is Jonathan Bloom, representing James Orenshaw, Burma Rhodes, who's representing the Nevada State University and Dean O'Neill, and Bradley Schrager represents Celine Torres and Brittany Miller, but he is unable to be here today. The respondents believe the court should affirm the district court for several reasons. First, NPRI was required to name the state and local government employers under NRS Chapter 41. Because this is an action against these public employees in their official capacity, and when an action is brought in an official capacity manner against a public employee, it's actually against their local or state governmental employer. They needed to comply with Chapter 41 and name the state on behalf of the particular department.
Was a tort action?
This is not a tort action. But recently, in the Echeverria versus State case, this court said Chapter 41 is not limited to tort actions, that it also applies to non-tort actions. It applies to all actions. And the North Carolina Declaratory Judgment Act does not create a jurisdictional basis. You only could proceed under that act if you otherwise have a waiver of sovereign immunity. In addition to failing to comply with the sovereign immunity statutes, NPRI also failed to name all the necessary party defendants. Not only the other legislators who hold dual role positions, but judges who also hold similar dual role positions who have adjunct professorships at the university system.
Let me ask you about the other legislators. My understanding was that when the case was filed 100 years ago, all of the dual role legislators were named. Some of them since resigned, retired, didn't seek re-election. And then after oral argument on these motions, but prior to the district court issuing her findings, NPRI moved to add the other relevant legislators who had been elected in the November 2022 election. Does that comport with what you understand procedurally occurred?
Generally, and had NPRI worked with the respondents, we would have agreed to allow them to amend their complaint to name those legislators because they're necessary parties. Absolutely necessary.
I totally would have expected that. I didn't see anywhere that there was an opposition to it. It's just that ultimately, for whatever reason, the district court judge seems to have done nothing with that other than put a footnote in her order saying, I don't really need to address that because of what I'm about to do in the rest of this order. So it doesn't appear to me anywhere that that ever got ruled on prior to the judge dropping the findings of fact, conclusions of law. Is that
correct? That is correct. Okay. The judge did not rule on it. The judge said that the motion would likely become moot, but the judge never actually ruled on that motion to join
parties. So how can we fault them for not including the parties when they tried to include the parties and the court didn't address it?
Well, they didn't try to include the parties until after there was a period of 4 months between oral argument in the district court and the district court's decision. Remember, the legislature moved to dismiss based on failure to join parties. They opposed. They could have simply worked with the legislature at that point and said, are you willing to allow us to amend the complaint to join the parties? And we would have said yes. They didn't try to do that. They opposed. Why they waited 4 months?
To be fair, I mean, I think the motion was filed within weeks of the certification of the November 22 election results.
But not all of the legislators that they wanted to name, I believe, were ones elected during the 2022 general election. There were several legislators who were still incumbents in office that they didn't capture the first time they brought the complaint. So they actually were under-inclusive before the 2022 general election.
But what about the argument that this is one of those situations where it's capable of repetition that will constantly evade review if we have to keep doing this dance every year that... You know, legislatures are, you know, every 2 years they're being reelected and some are leaving. And I mean, it just seems like a moving target.
This can be resolved by a litigation strategy undertaken by NPRI that's better than what they've been doing. Number one, they need to identify all their necessary parties. Two, they need to ask for expedited treatment in the district court based on the situation of wanting to get a resolution before the next general election. So really what needs to happen, if this does go back to the district court, is that following the 24 general election, they need to accumulate all necessary parties, move the case forward for discovery to obtain a factual record. Because this court, in the last case where we were remanded, you said we need a factual record. In the Heller case, this court said we need a factual record. In the two unpublished opinions, Summary Caruso, this court said we need a factual record. NPRI made no attempt to obtain that factual record or join any of the necessary parties.
Yes, but to the extent there are facts in the issue, it's true that deciding this case will create precedent one way or the other that benefits or detracts from different people's positions. That's true of any litigation that sets precedent at the Supreme Court level. And your position analytically is, as I understand it, that it depends on what the legislator who is accused of violating the separation of powers actually does for a living. Like if they are actually the governor and the legislator at the same time, they obviously can't serve in both roles, even under your analysis of that. But then it becomes factual and parsing between it. So it isn't automatically true that any ruling in this case will prevent someone who didn't get joined in the case from later arguing about factually it shouldn't apply to me because I clean the restrooms at UNLV, and I don't set policy. I'm not a member of the executive branch. Those arguments are all open to them. So how is it that they're absolutely necessary parties, particularly where this issue has been under litigation for years and years, approaching a century at this point?
Well, that's one of the reasons we have the joinder rules, to avoid piecemeal litigation, because that's what you're proposing, is that we go down the line and have litigation.
No, incremental litigation. We have incremental litigation. It happens all the time. The law advances an inch or two, and people are affected by the evolution of judicial pronouncements and have to live with them in future cases. You don't automatically include everybody who may be implicated by the outcome of the case.
But I believe it's feasible for MPRI to join everyone, and they should have their representation in this case under the due process.
You would concede it's not a jurisdictional problem.
Failure to join necessary parties is not jurisdictional. Chapter 41 is subject matter jurisdictional.
I understand your Chapter 41 argument. I'm on the necessary party issue.
Yes, but the necessary parties,
we have discretion to go ahead.
But the necessary parties also include the state and local government employers. They should be here speaking on behalf of these employees who MPI is trying to eliminate from their public employment.
That's your Chapter 41 argument.
It's both Chapter 41 and failure to join necessary parties. The state government, state and local government employers are also necessary parties.
Did anything impede them from moving to intervene? And why wouldn't that be a sufficient opportunity were it the case that they truly needed to be heard?
Because under the due process clause, the U.S. Supreme Court has said consistently, joinder of necessary parties is the way to proceed. A person who has knowledge of the case without service of process is under no obligation to intervene.
Right.
Didn't my recollection at the oral argument on the motions was that Ms. McCarty took the position that we were here on remand to explore the claims and develop a factual record, not to go backwards and readdress procedural requests. So how can you say that they're not trying to go and develop the factual record?
As soon as it was brought to their attention and they failed to join the necessary parties, they should have tried to add the parties and build that factual record. They could have asked us to agree to amend the complaint. They could even ask the court for an expedited discovery process. They didn't do that. And they're also resisting adding the judges. The judges who are adjunct professors in the same position as legislators who are adjunct professors, they need to be joined as well. The separation of powers issue is the same for the judicial branch.
Mr. Powers, assuming we get past that, can they serve in both? Can the judiciary serve as adjunct professors? Can the legislators serve in the executive branch? What's your position on the merits of this?
Well, yes, they can. Judges and legislators who are mere public employees in another branch of government do not violate the separation of powers provision. And we also believe that local government employees aren't subject to the separation of powers clause, and so that's not even a factor to be determined. If you find that local government employees are, then we believe those employees, like the state employees, don't perform sovereign functions, and they're not barred by the separation of powers provision. This is based a lot on history and common law. The history in both the federal government, members of Congress held executive branch employment positions until 1808, when Congress prohibited the practice. Before then, there's a record of the House of Representatives discussing this issue and concluding that the U.S. Constitution didn't prohibit members of Congress from serving as public executive branch employees. Then, the United Constitution, based on the California Constitution, exactly, in California, for the first 7 years of California's existence, there was a record of public employees serving in the legislature. It only ended in 1916 because the California voters approved the constitutional amendment prohibiting it. The framers did not think the separation of powers provision barred public employees from serving in the legislature. The history doesn't reflect that. This is a new spin that MPRI is providing here. It's not based on history, nor common law. This court has recognized the common law distinction between public officers and public employees since the very inception of the court. And that issue was a common law staple well before Nevada's existence as a state.
But Mr. Powers, I understand that argument. I do. But then isn't our starting place always with the actual language of the provision of the Constitution, right?
It is.
Before we get to history and meaning and framers' intent, we look at the language itself of the provision.
Look at the language, but that language has to be read in context of the common law. The framers understood the common law, they were ruined in the common law, and they, when they conveyed concepts in the Constitution, that was a concept they understood as the common law.
For the first 75 years of the enactment of the separation of powers constitutional provision in our Constitution in Nevada, which is broader and more robust than the United States Constitution's separation of powers, there was a separation, a complete separation between the three branches. And so if we're looking at historical, if we're taking a look in the rearview mirror, for the first 75 years, there was this clean separation. The word sovereign is not read into our Constitution anywhere, sovereign powers. And it wasn't until 1939, really, that we started to do this kind of commingling between the branches. So if you're arguing that we should be taking a historical view, I think that maybe that cuts against what you're trying to say here today.
With all due respect, Your Honor, in fact, we have evidence from affidavits of research that it was 1909 when there's records of the first public employee serving in the legislature, but there's no records before that. So we don't know. It's not true that no public employee served in the legislature before 1909. There's just no record to support that. We do know in California, though, there is a record that from inception of California in 1849 through their first 7 years of statehood, there were public employees serving in the legislature until the constitutional prohibition.
Let me circle back to Justice Kadish's focus on the actual text of this. And I'm curious, if you have a legislator, and we're looking at Article 3, Section 1, a legislator is exercising the powers of government of the legislature. You would agree with that?
Yes, correct.
So no person charged with the exercise of powers properly belonging to one of these departments, being a legislator, someone in the Nevada legislature, and then it says, shall exercise any functions appertaining to either of the others, judicial or executive, except as cases particularly directed. Can you give me an example of a legislator's dual role that would fall within this constitutional provision consistent with your arguments as to what it means?
Absolutely. The easy target would be state constitutional officers. The legislator couldn't serve as a state constitutional officer in the executive branch.
So the legislator can't be the governor?
Correct. That's okay. The easy
Anything
one.
Else?
Yes. If you go through all the statutes create various departments. They create heads of those departments, and they invest those heads with sovereign functions. So all the heads of the executive departments that are created by statute, those are public offices. They're created by law, and they have
any functions. It doesn't say sovereign functions. It says any functions, and any is really a broad, inclusive term.
And in our view, this term functions was used by the framers based on their knowledge of the common law to mean sovereign functions. They were relying on case law decades before Nevada's constitutional framing, where there was a distinction between public officers who exercise sovereign functions and public employees who do not.
So by your reckoning, it should have said that they shall not exercise sovereign functions, any sovereign functions.
We're saying that functions mean sovereign functions under the common law, and that's what the framers of the Constitution understood
Thank
and
you.
Used.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Powers, because one of my concerns is you're arguing today in line with how you briefed and argued the case below. I believe Ms. McCarty is doing that as well in the NPRI. That doesn't appear to be what the judge did in deciding the case. So we have that order up on appeal before us. At the end of the hearing, I mean, she says, look, I'm inclined to decline or deny the motion. I'm going to take it under advisement, and then ultimately drops down her order inserting this framework of incompatibility of offices doctrine rather than what you all briefed, which is troubling. I mean, it would seem that the district court should at least notify you all that there is some different way that she views this and give you the opportunity to brief it, no?
That would have been preferable.
That's very polite. I appreciate that.
But let me say this. The district court did rule on the merits of the issue and ruled in favor of the position of the LCB and the other respondents in this case, and we believe that that should be affirmed. But because the common law under the very first statute enacted in the state is the rule of decision in the courts of the state, then the district judge was free to look at the common law in addition to the constitutional question. Under NRS 1.030, it says the common law is the rule of decision unless where it's absolutely abrogated by federal or state constitution or statutory provisions. So the district court was not exceeding what it could have done, but yes, we would prefer to have some briefing in advance.
I mean, my my recollection, and I don't recall which side it was, but during the argument, there was some issue that came up about the judges. And somebody said to the court very directly, if there's anything persuasive about this, we want the opportunity to brief this issue if the court is looking at something different. Obviously, incompatibility of offices isn't the same thing as the judge's issue that was being discussed in that moment. But you all had kind of told the court, look, if you're going to look at something else to decide this, we want to be involved in that.
Well, Your Honor, if you want to admonish the district court, that's your free to do. I will not be doing that. Thank you, Your Honor. That is my time. I'm certainly open for any other questions.
Yes.
Thank you. Sure.
Mr. Powers, just to extrapolate on your colloquy with Justice Pickren. So heads of B&I, you know, heads of departments, no. A chief of staff to the governor, my law clerk, like who else other than those putative heads would you suggest could serve as a legislator concurrently?
Could not or could?
Could.
Anyone who doesn't fit within the well-established common law definition of what a public officer is. If you don't meet the two requirements of being a public officer, you're a public employee, you can serve in the legislature. I'm sure this court's aware of those two requirements. You don't need me to repeat them. Thank you.
All right. We'll add another 2 minutes on rebuttal. Another 2 minutes, yes.
Thank you. Briefly, I want to direct your attention to the case law that NPRI presented in its brief from our other sister states who have language that is either exactly the same or substantially similar to ours. The Supreme Court of Indiana found that legislators serving on boards and commission were engaging in dual service, and the reasoning was that it opens the door to influence and control of the legislature by the employing department. The Oregon Supreme Court found that a public school teacher like Assemblywoman Millers and Torres, who served as legislators, were also engaging in prohibited dual service, the same sort of analysis, coercive influence of the departments. Louisiana Supreme Court found that a legislator serving as an attorney for the State Highway Commission, similar to Senator Oldenshaw, was engaging in dual service.
He doesn't exactly represent a state agency as a public defender.
Well,
he represents indigent defendants.
Right, which is a state function. Again, we're talking about functions.
Counsel, what about
Gideon, I guess.
There's other jurisdictions, right, that go the other way, right? So Montana, New Mexico, Colorado. And I think maybe in those jurisdictions, there was a public policy concern, or at least a consideration. And I just want to get your take on it. You know, if we were to apply this more rigidly and completely cleanly, just separate out the three branches as the Constitution contemplates, is there any concern that we'll have a less qualified body of legislators or maybe less diverse group of legislators if we restrict it in that manner?
No, I don't believe so. The folks who are public employees still have representation in the legislature. There are lobbyists. There are their representatives themselves. To suggest that if we remove public employees from the legislature that somehow their interests will not be protected, I think, is just simply not correct. In closing, I'm going to remind you of a few things. Plain language, Settlemyer, powers, functions. When you look at those other states, the language is not the same as ours. It's powers versus powers. That's not what our framers did.
Ms. McCurdy, it was nice, but not to take away, if it's language and we were patterned after California and California permitted dual service until they amended their constitution, something that we have not done yet, what's my takeaway on that?
Your takeaway on that is to look at this court's precedent. And this court's precedent has been building since Galloway to this point to enforce the separation of powers provision as the framers intended it. Look at your case law. This court makes the difficult decisions when it must. And the case law here, as we've outlined in our briefs and as we've discussed today, makes it clear that the separation of powers was designed to rid the separate departments of government control or influence by either of the departments. And that result can only be obtained if the provision is enforced as written. And again, I'm going to encourage you, please, don't seek the middle ground here. If you all can't figure out which types of employees could serve, couldn't serve, how is the public supposed to figure it out? That would lead to more litigation. The public needs certainty.
And we would ask you please enter a merits decision. Judge Peterson brought this case, made a merits decision regardless of its contents. Make the merits decision. It is time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. Any other questions? No? Okay.